After Party Pod is brought to you by the book Ending Addiction for Good, which is by Cliffside Treatment Center founder and CEO Richard Tate and Dr. Constance Scharf, Cliffside's addiction researcher. Through self-disclosure, case studies, scientific facts, and firsthand experience, Tate and Scharf explain how anyone can recover from addiction. The book is great. I'm a fan of it. And I'm not the only one. It's received rave reviews, and it made it into the VMA's gift bag. And you just know those people need to hear this message. You can get the book on Amazon, of course, or by going to their website, which is cliffsidemalibu.com. So it's Anna here. Anna David, I hope you would know that by now. Of course you know that. You're listening to the After Party Pod. And today, my guest, I have a real treat for you. I always have a treat for you, but I think this is an extra special treat. My guest is a young gentleman by the name of Josh Leonard, and I learned today that he once preferred to be called Joshua Leonard, but nobody will call him that. And we have a kind of protracted conversation about why he seems more like a Josh than a Joshua. I can go on for a long time about names people have and whether or not those names fit them. I will have a thing where my brain will refuse to remember somebody's name simply because my brain has decided that name does not fit them. Anyway, he fits Josh. He doesn't really fit Joshua, in my humble opinion. He launched to superstardom as one of the stars of the Blair Witch Project. Back when that happened, remember that? Well, then he has gone on to establish himself in all sorts of incredible ways. I neglected to put his bio in front of me, and so now, of course, my brain is going blank. But he was in a film called Hump Day that won all of these awards. He directed a movie called The Lie. He directs music videos for Morcheeba and Fits in the Tantrums. And he's acted in a whole bunch of things. And he's about to leave to go shoot this movie called If I Stay, starring Chloe Moretz. And it's honestly the best script I've ever read. I say that without hyperbole. It's just a coincidence I've read it, and he is going to do that role. And he's a great guy, and he's sober. I told you I don't put things in front of my face because this is so casual and fun. I think he's sober. He just told me. I just did the interview today. 14 years, 15 years, a while. And we traveled. Travel still currently in the same sort of circle in LA, and as I tell him, you know, it was just one day. It sort of seemed like my sober friends were saying, "Oh, hey, yeah, Josh Leonard, you know Josh Leonard," and I was like, "No, I don't," and I felt that I was the only person who did not seem to know him, and then I did know him, and now I got to have a very long conversation with him. That boy can talk. He can talk, and then he can keep talking after that. And it's all very, very interesting. And I learned so much about him that I did not know. And so that is what's about to happen on this podcast. You may notice that the sound is exquisite, and that's because I have invested in some high-quality equipment. And that is for you guys. That is because I was getting feedback that people liked the content of the podcasts, but they weren't loving the acoustics. And I take feedback, and first I resent it, and then I tend to do something about it. And so I hope you're pleased with the result. I feel a little bit more professional. And so that is the new surprise this week. The new surprise coming next week, and I personally don't love just total surprises, so I'm telling you about this thinking you're like me, which you may not be at all. I'm going to be introducing a segment called House Calls with Laura House, who is actually the funniest person I've ever known. She is a comedian, and she's a meditation teacher, and she's a friend of mine, and she does my live show, True Tales of Lust and Love, as often as I can get her to do it, basically. And she's written on a bunch of television shows. And originally, when this podcast idea first came up, she and I were going to do it together. And we tried. And if faithful listeners will know that we did our very first one with comedian Carlos Herrera together. And then schedules got really crazy and we couldn't do it. And now she has some more time available. And so I immediately nabbed her and I said, let's do a section called House Calls. And what that is I'm going to throw out some terms related to recovery and addiction, and she is going to give her take, and her take on everything is hilarious. So that is something to look forward to next week. For this week, you get Josh Leonard. You're going to love it. Please, if you like the podcast, let me know. Email me at Anna@AfterPartyChat. Check out After Party Chat. You know, that is the parent site, the satellite site, if you will, for After Party Pod. And, you know, if you give it a star or 5 stars or however many stars you feel it deserves on iTunes, that helps the ranking of this podcast and helps other people to discover it. So thank you. And now I will introduce my guest, Joshua Leonard. No, we're going to talk about how, okay, hi, I'm recording.
Okay, great. That's
and
exciting.
I was just about to tell you how the way I became aware of you was there was a certain time in my sobriety where suddenly everyone's like, Josh Leonard, you know Josh Leonard. And I kept hearing that. And I go, well, no, I know who that guy is, but no, I don't know him. And I was like, no, you know him. Because we had all this friend to cross over.
But weren't you living in New York at that time?
Yeah, yes, I was.
Okay, so I think that's the caveat. Because I feel like there was a little bit of the same on the flip side, but that you were Anna David in New York.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, so you're saying you entered my friend circle. I moved away and you were like, there's a spot there, I'm freaking taking it.
That's one way of looking at it.
Wait, is your phone off, by the way? Because I just remembered mine.
It is completely
mine. Okay, good. So, but I do remember the very first time that I actually met you was at our friend Amanda's birthday dinner.
Birthday dinner.
I totally remember. It was at, we had this back patio of, I remember the restaurant. Maybe I'm obsessed with you and we're just learning it. No, I have a very good memory for random
and
things.
And we like sat in the corner and gave each other shit for a while.
Maybe that happened.
And then I wondered if we were going to have sex and then we never did.
We didn't have sex. I'm glad we can clarify that because I don't tend to forget things like that in my sobriety. I think that, okay, we did give each other shit. It was at Magnolia, back patio. And it was super fun.
Do you remember, because I believe it was this same night, Jessica S.,
okay,
who is fairly newly sober, young.
Took her shirt off?
And liked to show her tits a lot.
I know that person and that desire she has to do that. I don't remember her doing it that night.
She did a lot that night. I don't know where you were looking.
I was talking to you.
Okay, well, you know, I'm a guy, so I can hold a conversation and look at boobs at the same time. But she had, at the end of the night, she had one of my favorite lines of all times, which was she left after showing her boobs a bunch of times and taking up a lot of space in the conversation, but, you know, being funny and crazy and new. And she was off to some club somewhere, and I believe Andrew B. yelled out, "Don't get raped," to which she looked back and coquettishly tossed over her shoulder, "Can't rape the willing," and left.
Well, I don't want to break it to you. She didn't make that line up.
Did she not make that line up?
That's a line that funny people have been saying for a while.
I've been crediting her with that line for 8 years now.
I don't even remember her being there. It's like, you know, also with some people who are around, it's like I couldn't pick her out of a two-woman lineup. Like, I know who she is. We're Facebook friends. And like,
I mean, you'd have 50-50 odds.
I know.
I feel like you could pick her out of a two-person lineup.
Out of a three-woman lineup?
Yeah,
no.
You might be fucked.
Yeah, but okay, I'd say I have 50-50 chances on a two-woman. Like, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Like, I really don't really, but I do remember early in sobriety, I mean, no, not that early. I was maybe 5, and going out to lunch, so this was a daytime thing, and I remember her taking her top off at lunch, and me, I had such a confluence of emotions because I was judgmental and yet totally jealous of the attention she was getting and mad that I couldn't do things like that anymore to get attention because I knew better.
Yeah,
you know?
But she was also what? Like 21, 22, something
like
that?
And then 4 minutes sober at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I don't remember that. What I remember also about that night
did she really not invent that line?
I'm so sorry.
No, it's
unless
fine. It's
she
fine.
Invented
she,
it.
She's just gotten credit for that line a number of times in my retelling of the situation.
Well, I mean, mean, I don't...
So amongst a certain set, she did invent that
yeah,
line because
I mean,
perpetuated
truth,
that
perception
myth.
Is reality,
exactly.
Right? So if I interviewed a bunch of people about it and said, who invented that line, and they were friends of yours, you know, 100% of them might say that. But I mean, unless she's randomly told like a bunch of people in New York and then like it's filtered back. And I think I probably heard it as early as college when she might not have even been talking yet. I mean, I don't know.
Certainly not having sex.
Who knows? Maybe she was, you know, early, you know, so clever, she didn't need to have sex to do it. Who knows? This is what I also know. It kind of has to do with sex from that night, is that Amanda and I used to have a joke that we were each other's wives. I don't remember. Oh, I do remember. Whatever. It doesn't matter. And so we took a picture together. And then I put on Facebook that I was married to her.
Uh-huh.
And that was like, I was on a TV show then answering sex, dating, and relationship questions. So people like actually cared about these things. And I started reading on Messenger boards, did you know that Anna David is married to a girl? And so I realized nobody.
It was a scandal.
It was you think Jessica's line was a scandal. This like caused an uproar.
You know what?
Three people.
I mean, and welcome, because I'm completely complicit in it, that the like making jokes on social media is not the same as making a joke to three people sitting around a table.
No.
I
learned the hard way.
I mean, I posted a picture, two of my very dearest friends in the world. We all went to a movie last night. And
wait, I saw this and you said like something nice about them.
And I said these two forever, because out of probably my four dearest friends on the planet, like my lifer friends,
right.
These are two of them, and
right.
I happen to be seeing a movie with them. So I said these two forever.
So people think you're like a threesome?
One of those people happens to be on a hit TV show and has, you know, 75,000 Twitter followers.
Right.
Reposted it. And all of a sudden, my buddy calls me this morning because his French girlfriend is in New York and somehow saw it and thought that I was implying that these two were together, which I wasn't. I was just saying they're mine. Like, these are my people. These two forever.
Oh, my God. Evidently, I
wasn't demonstrative enough, and it started a whole bidi.
That's funny. I did think about it. I saw it, and I thought, and I thought, who are those people? And I am so clueless. I mean, so uninterested in fame. That's not true. But I didn't recognize whoever the person is on the hit show. I was just like, oh, who are those people? I don't know them. And
that's Bellamy. She's my oldest friend. She's on that show Scandal, which I think is also a show that
right. It lives up to its name.
That a lot of people are very intrigued as to what's going on both on and off screen on that show. So it may be a demographic thing as well.
But no,
or maybe I was implying that we were all in a polyamorous relationship.
I didn't think that. I mean, I know you a little bit, so that I said, to me, that just, you seem so like, you know, that was like, you're like feeling guy.
Like,
and these two
forever. I fucking love these people.
I read it, right?
Cool. Thanks, Anna.
Were you seeing 12 Years a Slave? Because I saw it last night.
No, we saw Kill Your Darlings.
Oh.
I think nobody had it in them to see the 10:40 show of 12 Years a Slave. Because you just don't even have recovery time after that.
Yeah, I don't think recovery is totally possible. That is a movie that changed me. Like, I really can't even.
Are you allowed to assess that the next day?
I knew it at the moment.
Okay.
I knew it at the moment. And I spoke at a meeting this morning, and like, I am somebody who doesn't get very like emotional. You know, I'm not one of these people who sort of is like, I have 10 years and like start weeping with gratitude. I'm just not that girl. And
right.
Every year I think maybe I'll become more that girl. Anyway, and I was sort of like, it was almost a manipulation. I was like, oh, I could be really emotional if I just think of this one line. Like, there's like this one line, and Pitt gave it to himself. Brad Pitt produced it, gave himself the line that is like, oh my, and like I just would think about it and
what's
get
the line?
No, I can't, it wouldn't mean anything.
What's the line?
No, I don't even remember the exact
context.
Line. No, I can't even tell you that. I've already told you too much. You've got to experience it.
Okay, I'll see it.
This is far too much about 12 Years a Slave and me, and not nearly enough about
what,
you.
It didn't, the over-emotionalism of latter sobriety did make me. So the other day... This is completely tangential. If you want to rein it back,
no, because I feel like you're the guy who would cry with gratitude.
I do sometimes. I mean, but I also cry because I'm sad once a decade.
Right.
I cry with gratitude depending on how spiritually fit I'm feeling, anywhere between like once a year and six times a day.
Hold on a second. Does our crying with gratitude relate to our spiritual fitness? This is a whole new anxiety for me. In your assessment, which we already know is wrong.
Because yeah, yeah. I mean,
wow.
In my case, I feel like if I am living in an unspiritually fit place, if I'm living in spiritual deficit, then gratitude and empathy are not very easily accessible to me. They're pretty deeply buried.
That I agree with, but crying. That going
okay,
to the next
so step. Maybe that's just because I'm a pussy and that's my response when I'm overwhelmed.
Okay, tell
anyway,
me a story.
So this is my story about Wednesday when I was officially a girl.
This past Wednesday.
But not you, evidently, because
I have a hardened heart.
Evidently I'm way more girl than you are.
You kind of are, but we'll get to that.
Okay, so Wednesday. I've just started seeing somebody.
Right.
A few months ago. I really like her, but we were avoiding any big talks at all. I'm about to leave town to go do your friend's movie for 5 weeks.
Yes.
And so I figured there would be some conversation in there, and which way was it going to go, and were we going to proclaim it a relationship before I left. So she's an actress. She was, she's been in rehearsals for 6 weeks. To do Wait Until Dark at the Geffen. And it's a hard part. I mean, they have been kicking her ass. She plays a blind girl. She's on stage the entire time. She's got like three fully blind fight sequences.
Wow.
She's just bruised from head to toe and has been working nonstop. Wednesday night is her opening night. Thursday morning, I happen to have a pitch in Santa Monica. I live in Echo Park.
Mm-hmm.
At 9 in the morning. Mm. Which means I got to get up at like 6.
7. Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
it's leave
6,
the house by
get,
7.
Leave the house by 7, get there an hour early, prep with everybody. So so I just tell her, I say, you know, look, it's your opening night. I'm going to be there. I'll come to the party afterwards. If, you know, I got to get home around midnight or so. Otherwise, I'll be fucked for the next day. And she says, "Well, but you know, I want to spend the night with you." And I was like, "That's great. I'll go to your house, or you can come to my house, whatever." But you know, it's also it's your night. If you want to rage because it's your night, and you're not an alcoholic, and
right.
if you want to have some drinks and
right.
stay out with your people, like
right.
you should fucking do that.
Right.
Because, so before I'm leaving the house. She sends me a text. She says, pack an overnight bag. And I said, why? She has rented us on her big night a hotel 2 blocks from my pitch the next morning.
Oh, wow.
So we can leave the show together, go spend the night at this hotel, and I'm right there where I need to be in the morning, which was kind of maybe the most considerate thing anybody's ever done.
Right.
So that happened, and then the next morning, so we spend this lovely night together, and I don't get any fucking sleep because we're in a hotel in
but
Santa
Monica.
But at
least Monica, the anxiety about getting
this.
Early, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the next morning, I'm getting ready to go, and I get a text from this guy, Jesus,
mm-hmm.
who was my brother who was in real bad shape a year ago and got sober. Was his counselor in rehab.
Uh-huh.
Because Thursday, the day of my pitch, the day after her show, was my brother's 1 year anniversary. And he was texting me to ask if my brother was still sober because he wanted to congratulate him, but he didn't want to do so if Johnny had fallen off the wagon. So I opened up that text and the flood of, you know, what was going on at this time last year, being on the phone twice a day with this guy, thinking my brother's going to die. I was single at the time. It just all hit me at once. And I just started fucking bawling. And my gal was very sweet about it. And I was, you know, 2 minutes before I could even tell her what I was responding to. And I was also on 3 hours sleep. So I was particularly susceptible. Then I show up at the pitch and MTV to meet with my writing partner, who's like the most, she's an insanely sensitive lesbian.
Right.
Like of all people you can be emotional around,
right.
She's the one. And I start retelling this story about what my gal has done and my brother having a year sober, and I start crying again.
Right.
And finally, she just slaps me and she's like, dude, this is a pitch. You can cry all you want later, but pull your shit together for the next hour and a half. It's like, oh, wow. Yeah. You're right. So I pulled it together. And then I made that girl my girlfriend.
Oh, how did you do that? You asked her.
Yeah, I was just like, I think you should be my girlfriend because I'm going away and I don't want to be confused about it. How do you feel about that? And she said, I feel awesome about that. And that was the end of the conversation.
Now, your story was very touching and led me to the conclusion that maybe I've just never had that much to be grateful for. It's like, my head was like,
Nobody's ever rented me a hotel room either.
But I think, I also think that since we're really, it's not about, it's who's more girly. Like, I like that about you. You know what I mean? And when we talked about this amazing part that you're going to do in this amazing movie, you told me that you cried.
Okay. So I've been crying a lot lately. Whatever.
The podcast known as Josh Cries. So, but no, and I loved that, you know? But also you're an actor.
I was just the other day thinking about Lily Taylor, Some Kind of Wonderful. Joe Lies. That was in Some Kind of Wonderful,
I think,
right?
That was Some Kind of Wonderful. Joe Lies when he cries.
Oh, my God. Song of all times.
Oh, my God. I have a weird thing about it. It doesn't matter. Like, but I do have a weird thing. Like, my dad used to laugh at me when I cried. Like, I have a hard time. I can cry. Trust me.
When's the last time you cried?
Oh, I am female. Like, I cry. You know, I cry over things being sad and not going right. I mean,
The second I actually get hurt, I shut the fuck down.
Right.
That's where it's harder
for
me to cry.
Okay, good. Now I feel superior to you because I was having a total inferiority complex for the last 10 minutes. Okay, good. I'm good at. I'm good at, ow, that hurt. I'm going to cry. I mean, I know that also.
We're like a full human being between the two of us.
We could be perfect. Can you imagine? Can join us now.
And we'd just evidently be crying all the fucking time.
But anyway, I don't know how we got so sidetracked. I mean, I do know because I don't start these with any sort of rhyme or reason.
Okay.
But
I feel like for the four people who are listening's sake, we should take a hard left here.
Okay.
For the seven people
who
are listening.
For the 8 or 9 people who'd bother to download this.
For the 14 people who are loving this right now.
Who haven't stopped listening.
We should try to stay one step ahead of them and take
an exciting ride.
90 degree turn into something.
Okay, let's talk about you.
Okay.
I do want to, I have this dedication to doing chronological order with things because I want to get to in the end maybe the letter that you wrote your brother that I was able to publish and how many people have reached out to me about that. Oh my God, I'm gonna see if I can make you cry. It's happening a little. No, it's not.
No,
it's not.
No,
it's not.
It's
no,
not.
I know
it,
when it's happening.
It might happen.
Okay.
Yeah, but the forewarning, like you kind of fucked yourself.
Yeah. No, I didn't know. I know that I have one of these.
The challenge of it is all.
Please don't cry. Please. Actually, it's not allowed in this apartment. I am the only one allowed to cry here. because I know you, and then I went and did a little research and learned some interesting things. You know, from what I read, and you can tell me if this is all true or not.
What's true, what's not true.
Yeah.
What people have fabricated, what I fabricated.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Sure.
This is the real Josh Leonard. And you prefer Joshua, or is it more like professionally you're Joshua?
No, I always introduce myself as Joshua,
right.
And nobody ever calls me Joshua.
Yeah.
And I don't really care.
Right.
But it's just, that's just the way it goes, so.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it's like,
I like the, I, you know, at like 12 or 13, I was like, I'm an adult. I'm going to use the name Joshua Leonard.
Yeah.
So that's how I started. And then you're like, oh,
nobody sees me as an adult. No, that's not why. I think there are Joshua Leonards. I mean, I'm sorry. I think there are probably are other ones. There are Joshuas who seem more like Joshuas who seem like a Josh. I mean that as a total compliment.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, like those people that are like, I'm Jonathan. And you're like, okay, so John. No, Jonathan. Like, I don't see you being a corrector.
I'm never a corrector.
Right.
But there evidently is a difference in perception between how I see myself and how other people see me.
But I think it's good. It's fine. I think it's good. If people say Anna, you better believe I correct them.
Uh-huh.
And try to shame them a little bit.
Anna.
Pretentious girls go by Anna, I'll say. No, there's somebody who does it to me, like, he must be trying to hurt me.
Can you imagine, either by choice or by design, having one of those names that phonetically looks one way?
Oh, like Seamus?
But you have decided that it's going to be pronounced another way, or your parents have decided that, so your entire life is a series of correcting people as to the pronunciation of your name?
Like, give me an example.
Okay,
but I do think Seamus is a good example of, because I'm a very, I think about letters. Uh-huh. Like, when I say somebody's name, I'm actually spelling it out. Whether that makes me brilliant or retarded, I'm not sure. But so, we have a friend named Seamus,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see him, and I'll go, hey, Seamus, because, like, my brain is spelling it.
Your brain is seeing the letters. Yeah.
And it's going, that doesn't seem, that
but
doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, Anna is a perfect example. Is some people are Anna and some people are Anna.
Well, you know, the cool people are Anna, so it only takes a quick snap judgment to understand what to call me. And being correct about that. So anyway, you were like, you grew up, where exactly did you grow up?
I was born in Texas. Mm-hmm. I was born in Houston. And then around the time my mother got pregnant with my brother in 78, so I was 3, they wanted to get out of Texas, and he took a job working for Penn State University.
And he was a drama teacher.
He was a drama teacher. He was artistic director at the Alley Theater in Houston when I was born. And then wanted to go into academia, took this job running a MFA directing department at Penn State, and moved the family there. So my brother was actually born in central Pennsylvania. And then I was raised there until I guess I was 15.
And you were like a bad kid, kind of. A troublemaker.
I was a wonderful kid until I was probably like 11 or 12.
Right.
And then I got angsty.
Uh-huh.
And that all kind of went out the window. And then I was a holy terror.
Really?
For the next few years. And then wound up actually like leaving at 15. So it just became my problem as opposed to other people's problems.
So the holy terror, what embodied that? What were you doing?
Well, I mean, my dad was a drama teacher. My mother, I was going to say my mother was a mime by trade, which isn't exactly true. However, she did study mime for years.
That's amazing.
But, you know, she was a sensitive, artsy woman. She studied with Marcel Marceau in Paris.
Oh, wow.
I think in the 60s. In the 60s, she did. So, you know, and she was, they were broke. I think my dad's opening salary was like 12 grand and my mom was working odd jobs. So we were, in my early life, everybody was just kind of scrambling.
And it's just the two of you, you and your brother?
Me and my brother. Scrambling and working all the time. But that said, they were very sensitive, creative, artsy, kind of hippie-esque people. We got this little rundown farmhouse in a town called Oak Hall, where our neighbors were the Gillilands and the Biddles.
Nice. Can't make these names up.
Can't make those names. I didn't even realize that was weird until so much later in life. I didn't realize how specific those names were. Evidently, the Grand Dragon of the local chapter of the KKK lived about a mile and a half from us.
We're nice.
And we had a little, it was like a little farmlet. I mean, it was run down, but we had goats and chickens, and we lived right on a stream, and I learned to ride the riding mower when I was 7, and We had an apple orchard. And
see, this sounds kind of idyllic.
It was totally idyllic. And I started out school in a Quaker school. Mm-hmm. So I was going to Quaker school and going home and being like an artsy hippie kid and collecting flowers and listening to John Denver. And then around fifth grade, they put me in public school. And I all of a sudden realized that I lived in this super redneck football town. And I started getting my ass kicked.
Right.
And like all the creative conflict resolution of the Quaker school did not really apply, and it was really into the fire very quickly. And so you know, for a couple of years, I took it on the chin, and I was just kind of like a dorky kid.
And they would literally just beat you up.
Yeah, I mean, all the mean things. I just can't even imagine growing up in cyberbullying culture. Mm. You know, and somebody brought up the other day, at least in, you know, in the 80s, you had the respite of, like, walking away from it at the end of the day.
What do you mean?
I mean, you went home and it stopped.
Right.
You know, and then you would go home to my family and the right. Cosby Show or like whatever right. form of...
Right, but now it's oppressive and 24/7.
But now if you're a kid who gets bullied, you just, you know, it doesn't stop. You go home and it keeps going on.
Did you see that movie that like Jason Bateman is in? Oh my God. His son is the victim of... It's the most intense movie about that. Can't remember what it's called, and it's a very flawed movie, so my bringing it up is pointless. Go on.
So then I guess it took me a few years to come up with a plan for how to deal with it. So like fifth grade, I think I devised a plan so I could keep working through recess and not have to go outside and deal with the playground.
Did you have any friends?
Not really.
Mm-hmm. So there was just no kids like you there.
Not really, because I did that weird... I mean, I guess I always had that thing that ran in well into my junkiedom where like I was either better or worse than. Right. Where like I did not want to associate with the other dorks.
Oh, right.
Just to have solidarity.
Right.
And I definitely was not a cool kid.
Right.
So I was just gonna be alone.
Solo, yeah.
I was gonna be alone and I was gonna be fine with that.
Yeah.
And like build papier-mâché castles inside while everybody else was playing kickball.
So did your plan work? Were you able to work through recess?
I was able to convince him to let me work through recess. And then I guess sixth grade was the first time that I really got into trouble. That's when how old are you? 12-ish?
11. You're 11. 11, 12.
Yeah, something like that. I had started stealing liquor from my parents' liquor cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't even really gotten drunk at that point. I would drink sometimes, but I was using it. I decided it's almost like this conscious decision that you make when right. you're that young, where you're like, oh, I'm going to be a bad kid.
Right.
Because I didn't necessarily, maybe if you have an older brother or something, right. I didn't have a template.
So nobody introduced you to the idea of drinking. Like, how did you even know that that was an option? You just sort of saw.
Yeah, my pop drank every day. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he was, you know, he was somebody who would come home from work and have a beer or right. a glass of sherry or something. And you know, culturally, I think, you know, at a very young age, you start getting imprinted as to what's cool.
Right.
Via media. And so I remember, and then there were like porn magazines that, like, Playboys that we'd stolen. I did know this one kid, the friend that I'd had from Quaker school, and he lived on a farm outside of town. They were like a full Apple and Basset Hound farm. And at one point he told me that one of the family's farmhands had a stack of Playboys under his bed out in, like, the back cabin. It's another, I mean, when I tell these stories, it's like I'm the old guy. It's like back in my day.
Well, no.
I mean, it's just, think about how much has changed in our lifetime. I've got friends with teenage kids who are like, every time I go on his computer, he's erased the history.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, so we planned a fully covert reconnaissance mission to go get these Playboys. So then I started showing up to sixth grade.
Keep talking. I'm getting you a water.
Okay, so thank you. With little bottles of vodka, uh-huh, and Playboy magazines. And the social currency of those things is pretty big. So even though I was a bad kid, that was like I was kind of the go-to guy.
No more paper mache at recess.
No. And that... You know, that really Tai Chi'd the power back in my direction until one of the fellow reject kids found out this and decided to make a power play and narc me out.
To the teacher?
To the principal. So I remember, because I had a good run. It was probably like a few weeks where...
That's not very long, though.
At that time, it's like a lifetime.
Yeah.
It's a lifetime when people are like, hey, what are you doing at recess? You want to come out?
And, right.
And sneaking into the cornfield out behind our school and taking little nips of vodka and, you know, feeling cool.
Right.
And then I think it was Ben Maddy. Ben Maddy found out about all this, and he was not cool. Like I, he was not cool at
he was
at,
jealous
at me raising my social station.
Yeah.
So he narked me out, and I knew it was happening. Somebody gave me the heads up that it was happening, and I remember getting to the end of day at school that day and thinking, I'm going to make it out of here, because I'd only been, by the time I found out that he'd narked me out, I was in the classroom, like, last period, headed to the bus. So I couldn't even go to the bathroom. I couldn't get rid of the evidence.
Right.
So I remember walking down the hallway towards the bus, like the scene in the movie where, like, you're just about to make it to freedom.
Yeah.
And hearing Josh Leonard,
right,
screamed from behind me. And I just kept walking until I was tackled from behind by the gym teacher. And I tried to run, and he pulled me back and threw me in the office. I tried to run again, and it was like, I was like a weird, geeky sixth grade kid, and they were blocking me, and then they finally got my backpack and searched it and found a couple Playboys and some vodka.
Yeah.
And I remember it occurring to me that night, because they sent me home, and they were like, we'll deal with this tomorrow. And I remember that night trying to come up with all the ways that I could potentially get out of it. One being, could I break into the school, steal back the evidence, and then they couldn't prosecute me? I mean, I was working this lawyerly
pretend
way.
That they were
pretend
mistaken.
That they never found it, or that it was just water in that bottle. But I didn't do any of those things because that wasn't that cool.
I mean, and it was National Geographic, not Playboy. Replace the magazine.
Exactly.
That would have been some commando cool shit. That didn't work. Go on.
Anyway, so that happened. I got suspended for a while. But you know, the seed was already planted. You know, illegal shit makes you cool. And so...
And did drinking do something for you, too, that, like, unleashed?
You know, if I was 12 at that point, it probably wasn't until I had just turned 14, like late 13 or 14, that I actually got drunk for the first time. Mm.
So you were more just passing it around.
I was completely using it for the social currency of it.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
I mean, I was a drug dealer for years. And
later.
Later. Later. I mean, you know, kind of 16 to 18 or so. But such a huge part of that was just the social currency of being the guy
so
who had the shit. So yeah, what happened? I went to junior high. Seventh grade sucked. I started getting into a lot of trouble. Eighth grade, I went to an alternative school. Kind of all bets were off at that point. I mean, it was one of those schools where if you were brilliant in self-discipline, you could have a really great program, but it was kind of a combination between those kids and like straight up criminals.
Right.
And you know.
And you could kind of get by like no grades or something crazy.
No,
like that.
We actually had my phys ed class was taught by a woman named Karen Grubb. Mm-hmm. It's like 275 pounds and a chain smoker. And the class was actually called Making Hard Balls Go Where You Want Them To. And it was bowling and miniature golf and pool. And that was our gym class. And we would go to the bowling alley and we would chain smoke cigarettes with Karen Grubb and get gym credit for it.
By the way, as an adult who does not know how to play pool, I wish I had been taught that in school.
It's kind of a cool thing to know.
I mean,
know.
I'm sad now that I don't...
What is it they say? Good pool player is a sign of a misspent youth?
Oh, is that what they say?
I think there's something about that.
I had somewhat of a misspent youth, so apparently it doesn't cover all.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Marin County.
Oh, okay.
So, like, very well-dressed derelicts there. You know what I mean?
you were blacking out behind the wineries every night?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was...
You got so fucked up at Coppola's Vineyard, man. It was crazy.
No, that was not the
vibe.
That
Malbec really laid me out.
No, it was more like when I was in high school, I was just talking about this at the thing I was talking about before, the Grateful Dead. I mean, like, I'm old, so it's like the Grateful Dead, like all of them were still alive.
Sure.
And that was the vibe. That was what everybody did, you know? I think addiction is very like accepted and commonplace there. I mean, kids at my high school, got sober. One of them is still sober and lives in LA and like,
that's
you probably
insane.
Know that guy. And like, he's wow. sober 30 years or whatever
that's
it is.
Amazing.
No, I mean, 10 years. I just graduated. But
7 years,
something like that. So anyway, so then you dropped out of school. I read. Is that true?
So then, yeah. So I made it through the alternative school. Essentially what happened was I even wound up getting into massive trouble there. And then I had really started drinking and using just all the time. So I was like, these minimal classes that they want me to go to, like, that's too much. I'm not going to do that. So I had been... You know, I had been truant for so long at one point that they essentially just withdrew me from my entire school district. And then I was still in town and I would go back and I'd sell weed to kids at the high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, this is also tangential, but maybe interesting. I remember going back. And the social studies teacher named Daryl coming out because I was kind of on school property, but, you know, like fucking McConaughey and Dazed and Confused,
right.
Like just hanging out on the outskirts and him coming out and his face just being bright red going, if you ever fucking show up on this property again, I will have you dragged away in handcuffs, which was true until... about 7 or 8 years ago when they invited me back to be an alumni speaker, which I desperately wanted to do. And was trying to work out the date and ultimately couldn't because I couldn't get out of this job that I was working on for the dates needed. And I wrote with deep apology that I wasn't going to be able to make it back. And they said, it's okay. We had Jerry Sandusky as a backup. He's going to fill in for you.
Pre-scandal.
pre-scandal. Yeah, this was 7-8 years ago. But he was like the hero, one of the heroes.
Now you are. Now you are the hero.
Nine.
Well, wait a minute.
I think to like 6 or 7 people. And
well, I mean,
kind
you
of the shame
him.
Of the others.
Yeah, because
not as much. I mean, he definitely replaced me in terms of bringing public shame to the town.
I would say so. I would say so. But I can't believe you were that guy. You were like that. Oh shit. You know, the teacher's kind of confabbing. Josh, did you hear Josh Leonard's here? Yeah. Did you know he's stealing drugs, Joshua? Oh, my God. Did you know, like, you were that kid?
No, I was totally that kid. But, and at the same time, imbued with, you know, high school dropout, but from an educated family. So, I was, you know, I was sensitive. I could hold a conversation. Right. I think people would have probably said precocious.
Right.
Like fucking annoyingly so, I'm sure.
Right.
You know, 14, and I was like, I'm an adult.
Right.
Don't fucking tell me what to do. I'm an adult,
right.
And you're dumb.
Right.
But I remember it, and this sounds like one of those things that people make up, and it's not. I remember the first time I blacked out. I was about 14, and I had this 19-year-old goth friend named Art, and we went to his parents' house, and we made a bunch of, like, blender drinks, and just drank blender drinks until I fully fucking blacked out, and woke up in a pile of my own vomit.
Mm-hmm.
Passed out in a guest room that had no furniture in it, on the floor, just my face.
Ouch.
In my own vomit.
Oh.
On a Berber carpet, with his mother standing above me with like a bowl of hot water and 409 and just like throwing it in front of my face going, clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then later that day, after cleaning it up and like trying to slink out of the house unnoticed, I passed by the dining room. Art was still asleep at this point, where his mother was talking to one of her friends, and I passed by as I heard the words, and he seemed like such a nice boy.
Oh, God. So, okay.
So yeah.
And so then you left.
So then I left. I wound up, I was 15 when I got kicked out of my school district. Made a deal with my parents that, I mean, and there was, you know, shit that happened in between. I had to go to summer school. I got thrown in a boys' home for a while because I was incorrigible and kept getting arrested in my hometown.
For drug dealing?
For drug possession, for stealing, and also for, I think they literally call it incorrigibility, where my parents would be like, you're 15, come home. And I'd be like, fuck you, I'm not coming home. And one time I got into actually a physical confrontation with my father, and they called the cops, and the cops came and dragged me off to the holding cell, and then a social worker showed up, you know, and my parents were like, we're not taking you back.
Yeah.
And I got sent for a couple months to a boys' home, outside Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. And I just remember the first night in the boys' home, like, you know, sweet, fucked up, educated white kid in a room full of kids who have been in the system.
Right.
You know, most of their lives. And just, and the conversation that went on the first night I was there, I was laying in my bunk bed. And somebody was like, hey, Jimmy, come on over here and whack my shit. It's like, I ain't gonna whack your shit. You know what feels better when somebody else whacks your shit? And then what seemed like the entire room started making deals as to who was going to whack whose shit.
Oh, my God.
And then I sat there and listened to at least a few of these guys, like, jacking each other off.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, where am I?
Wow.
What the fuck happened to my life?
Right.
And I was 15. So I went to summer school. I wound up doing a year at a boarding school in Michigan. And that was kind of the deal. Like, make it till you're 16 and we'll emancipate you and you can go off and do whatever the fuck you want. So, 15 to 16, I was at this boarding school, and then I found a program after that year that would take me. It was kind of like a Peace Corps type program, but it was one that would take me as a minor, take me at 16. And I came home that summer, back to Pennsylvania from Michigan, and kind of had a big blowout, and then moved to southern Mexico for what wound up being a year and a half.
And by then you were almost 18.
No, I was 16. I was 16.
And I was counting a year and a half, so I was saying almost 18.
Oh, by the time I came back, yeah.
I'm trying to get you to New York.
You're trying to get me to New York. Well,
I'm enjoying the journey. I'm just subtly manipulating and guiding you.
Okay, so I was down there, no drinking age, got really fucked up, learned to speak Spanish pretty fluently.
I have a question.
Yeah.
The drugs at this point was just pot, or were you doing other things?
Oh, no. I mean, early on, 14 was like pot and booze and acid, a lot of acid. Mexico was pot and hash and booze and coke, which I started doing for the first time down there. I still don't think I've ever had coke that was as good as the coke in Mexico.
Well, yeah.
Pretty close to
the source. I don't know if you ever had the coke in Paris.
I never had the coke in Paris.
I mean, I can't talk about wines, braggart, but I can talk about the coke in Paris. That was like, it was like snorting heaven. It was unbelievable. I mean, it's disgusting to me now, but it was, yeah. At that time, it hit the spot. Go on.
Sure.
Yeah.
No, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
I'm jealous of that experience that I never had. What happened? Came back. I got into a little more trouble. Lost my virginity. Decided I wanted to try college, got into this college, super liberal hippie school in Washington State, called the Evergreen State College, moved across the country to Olympia, Washington, made it like a semester at that college, and had met a gal, my first real girlfriend, Courtney, when I was back in Pennsylvania for the minute before I left for school. And she came out. I started doing meth at this point, which was just crank at that time. Because my house in Tumwater, Washington, was right next door to a Harley biker family. And so I was kind of in the hippie school, and I was getting mushrooms from Eugene, Oregon, and a lot of weed, and selling that to the kids, and then I started trading crank with them. I was like, this stuff is amazing. Wow. I can get a lot done.
Right.
And just like how fucking dark that was. Dutch, the head of the biker family, coming over at like 4 o'clock in the morning out of their double wide trailer, just going like, Leonard, you gotta shut the fuck up, man. Like, okay, I just got to finish this thing first. He's like, what the hell are you even doing? I'm like, I'm just scrubbing the moss off my roof with this dish towel. I'm almost done.
Like, getting stuff done that didn't need to be done.
That never needed to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. I never really did it, but everybody I know who did, like, took apart computers to try to put them back together better.
Exactly.
You know, tasks like that.
Yeah, no, because you have superhuman abilities. Find shit that's buried in your face.
Ow.
A lot of face excavation that went on. Courtney came out. I dropped out of school. We moved to Seattle.
Talking. I'm getting water.
Okay, get water. We moved to Seattle. Seattle, mid-90s. There were no drugs there at that point.
None.
But I'd also really started, what I'd started to get my shit together on at that point was photography. And You know, and it was something that I really loved. And I started shooting for some of the local papers, and I wound up shooting a lot of that, you know, the kind of music scene that was going on at that point, both That's live awesome. Stuff and portraits. And I really enjoyed that. And that kind of, you know, that went hand in hand with the drugs and staying fucked up. And I didn't really need to be too lucid to do my job.
Right.
Courtney and I had a terrible relationship. Just awful to each other. Wound up breaking up.
Were drugs a part of that? I mean, did she do drugs? And
yeah, I mean, she never really got into speed or any of the harder stuff, but you know, she smoked a lot of pot and drank a lot, and that was a big part of our relationship. And by the time I left there, I mean, I was a fucking mess. In fact, we had a buddy of mine. I had a really off the rails bipolar best friend who was living in our basement at that point. And he finally put me in the back of his van and like drove me back to the East Coast. Cause I was just a mess.
I thought you were going to be like, and took me down to the river to drown me. When you said bipolar, when you started it with that, I was like, what does that mean? Okay. And so then
I was able to, through people I'd met in the photo scene in Seattle, I was able to get an internship, an assistant position at a fashion studio in London. So I moved to London.
Okay.
And kept taking pictures there for a while. And that was the first time that I got strung out. Which also, I mean, very much like finding drugs earlier in life. Every decision that I've made to make myself more fucked up has been completely on my own volition.
Right.
I was never pressured once.
Yeah.
I remember I was living in Earl's Court and working on Brick Lane, and I came home once and you're always looking for the nod from the dealers, and I was trying to find some hash, and he's like, "Don't have any hash." And I was like, "What do you have?" And he was like, "Brown." I was like, "What's that?" He's heroin. I was like, "Oh, I want some of that. Definitely want some of that."
Right. And you just snorted it. You didn't know how to shoot
it. I smoked it. I loved smoking things at that point. I had loved freebasing meth. I had loved, you know, putting cocaine on my cigarettes.
Yeah, I used to do, what are the Cocoa Puffs?
Cocoa Puffs.
And I thought I was really cool.
Loved that shit. So I started out chasing the dragon. And very quickly formed a habit.
Yeah.
And didn't have that many people that I used with, but there was this one German guy in my building. I lived in a bedsit. You know, I'd go get fucked up with him. And then I'd say I didn't know I was strung out at the time, but,
right.
But you know, I was strung out, and that lasted about 6 months. And then at one point I went down to find him and found him OD'd and dead on his floor.
Oh,
and
it had
probably been that way for a few days. So it was a really gnarly, rigor mortis. It looked like he had puked blood. So it was just, dried blood caked between all his teeth. I called the cops. I freaked out. It's one of those moments where you're like, "Oh, this is dark.
This should be a wake up call.
This should be a wake up call." So I did. I quit.
And you were using the same heroin that he was, I'm assuming, that he OD'd on.
Ostensibly, yeah, I would assume so. I mean, we kind of bought from the same guys in the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I quit cold turkey after my first run. And, you know, there was no awareness of programs or sobriety,
right,
or any, I mean, not for years to come, but okay, I gotta quit doing heroin. So I quit, and moved out of that apartment and just kind of, you know, drank a lot of, Guinness and had in the meantime started doing a lot of the live stuff for Time Out magazine in London.
Shooting live stuff.
Shooting live stuff. Photography. while working at this fashion studio. And they were just, this was right when they were opening up Time Out New York. And they asked me if I wanted to go shoot for Time Out New York. So I said, totally. And, you know, it was a way to get out of London. It was a way to go to New York with a job.
Yeah.
So I left and I moved to New York City, and here we are at New York. That only took 54 minutes.
No, and the only reason, because you had this flash in your eyes that like a little bit hurt. I'm not saying that I hurt your feelings, but like I'm loving every word you're saying, but I am, because you are.
Please don't love every word I'm saying.
No, I apologize now for loving every word you're saying. But you are so busy. And so I just want you to be aware of the time, because I know that we have a time.
It is 1:30. I'll tell you what, let's do this.
Uh-oh.
Let's pause it.
Okay.
I'm going to pee.
Okay.
And then I'll come back and we'll do like another 15 minutes. Okay. And you'll tell me exactly what you want to talk
okay.
about.
Okay. Right. Done. No, I have to press it again. There, we're back. How exciting.
How excited. But just so you guys know, we didn't talk about anything. You didn't prepare me the way that you said you were going to.
No, because we're on a time schedule, and I think only of you. I also think that it's kind of fun to keep people on their toes a little bit.
Keep me on my toes.
So we got you to New York. Congratulations to both of us. Woo! I didn't even know you were a photographer. I had no idea about this part of you. I did not know you lived in London. I didn't know any of this. Think of all I'm learning.
The internet, it only tells part of the story.
It only really tells part of the story. But the story that it likes to tell is especially about Blair Witch. So,
sure.
So, this is what
and you know how much I love to talk about that.
I know you have talked about nothing else with me constantly. Should we talk about the time that you called me kind of fat? Do you remember this?
No, not at all.
Okay.
You have no idea
that like this is like festered in my brain. Okay. I know we only have 15 minutes. There was one. Okay. Right when I moved back from New York.
Uh-huh.
And I was back and we ran into each other. And I swear to God, you cannot tell me I imagined this. I'm super self-conscious because I'm like relatively thin except in my stomach.
Uh-huh.
And I swear to God, you walked up to me, and in this like adorable way that you have, you touched my stomach, and you went, "Oh, pooch," or something like that.
Oh, that's a totally different thing than calling you fat. I did somebody like
do you
I.
Remember it now?
No, but that I believe I could have done.
You did it
because I never would have walked up to somebody and been like, "You're kind of fat."
Right. Right.
But on a fit woman, a tiny little pooch is so sexy.
I wish you had said that instead of forgot every word but pooch in that sentence. And I was like, oh my God, Josh Leonard totally thinks I'm fat. And I remember I went to I went out with people afterwards. I was at Swingers talking about it. And they're just I'm sure he doesn't.
Horrible human being.
No, I mean, now that you filled in the rest of the sentence,
inadvertently horrible. No, I would never come up, especially to somebody who's not like an intimate friend and point out something that I thought was a flaw.
Right.
It was definitely something that,
Yeah, no, and you did do it.
There was an affection, right?
There was an affection, and it was said admiringly. What you don't know is that you do know I'm female, but I'm normal with food and eating, just barely. You know what I mean? I'm so grateful because I I come from a family that's crazy with food,
uh-huh.
But it's like, get me a little bit going. And I can so be there and just like body dysmorphia and like obsessing over it.
Oh, that's terrible. I'm so sorry.
No, this was not, I did not bring you here and start tape recording.
No,
this
I'm really. Apology. I mean, this was also, you know, we as boys becoming men learn things about women and learn rules
totally.
As the years go on that we don't know earlier and. Yeah.
No, but the thing was, I will, like, when I was, like, saying, like, I would sort of, I, like, sort of said it to someone. They were like, Anna, he didn't call you fat. Like, I knew that I was going crazy with
okay.
it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay, I'm so glad we could work through that.
I'm really sorry.
No, don't feel really,
By the way, have you seen my 15 to 20 pound weight fluctuation in the years since? Totally came back on me.
No, I don't.
I definitely had people come up and be like, you pretty big right now, aren't you?
You do that?
Yeah.
You can't do that to a woman. I mean, people don't do that to women. I mean, I've been 25 pounds heavier than I am now. Oh. And nobody said a word except my parents, who ordered me to a nutritionist and paid for it.
That's very sweet.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, some of the food issues come
from
them.
As opposed to my Jewish mother, who's like, you look so healthy.
Yeah.
You must be eating. Thank God.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, right now, I'm at my most comfortable, like, I mean, I'm pretty much in shape. I'm eating healthy.
You look great.
This is what my body looks like. And according to my mother, I'm starving myself. I mean, I'm 180 pounds. I'm not starving myself.
Oh, my God. If we could combine our two mothers, much like if we could combine us, we'd be perfect. Yeah, my mother's 99 pounds. She's 4'11". Not a lot.
My mother's 4'11", too.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. We have so much in common. No, but yeah. And my mom doesn't eat flour sugar. And it's just like, yeah, no, definitely notices every. And I had a grandmother, not her mother, interestingly. So it comes from both sides, who would greet me with a, like, she'd give me a little, like, air kiss in my ear, go, you've gained weight.
Oh, that's awful. Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it fascinating? At this age, every time you realize, you're like, oh, it's my fucking mother again?
Yeah.
Oh, it's my grandpa. It's that thing that happened to me when I was 5.
0 to 7.
Again?
0 to 7. Everything important happens. Insane. All the stuff we need to undo.
It's insane.
I know.
It's so tiresome.
Okay, but here's what I'm going to say.
Yep.
So this is what a quote that I read that you said about the Blair Witch Project. It was just another thing that happened in the confluence of events of being young and really high in New York and trying to figure out what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Accurate?
Totally accurate.
And so,
yes, I did say that. And that would, and let's just contextualize. I made Blair Witch Project while I was still loaded.
Yeah.
It came out when I was sober.
Right.
So because there was about a year and a half, almost 2 years, between the time that we shot the movie and when it actually even, I was in sober living when I went to Sundance.
Yeah, I knew that because they describe it as a halfway house, and I love how the press will do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you sound like you're, yeah. So yeah, you were in sober living when you went on The Tonight Show to promote the movie.
I don't know if I was in, I think I was probably living in, just out of there. I was definitely there. No, because by the time the movie came out, I'd moved in with one of the producers and his family. I mean, literally into a broom closet in their house in Sherman Oaks. And that's where I was when the movie came out. And then I shared an apartment in West Hollywood with a guy. So I was out of sober living at that point. But definitely when we were at Sundance and doing press, doing the first wave
newly
of press.
Sober.
Brand newly sober, like still going to these parties at Sundance and going back and checking in with the sober house 2-3 times a day.
And I remember I went to Sundance newly sober, and it was extremely challenging, actually. You were distracted by being like the star of Sundance, right?
Well, and also I'd been there the year before. That was 99.
Yeah.
In 98, I had been at Sundance as a photographer for Black Book magazine, which was my first year at Sundance, and I'd driven like an 84 Chevy Nova across the country because I decided I was going to kick heroin
at Sundance
on a road trip to Sundance. and like sleeping in my car half the time and sweating. I mean, the bad ideas of all the ways that I thought I was going to kick heroin.
I mean, that's a phenomenally bad one.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not quite as bad as the time I decided I was going to hike the Appalachian Trail and be totally detoxed by the end.
God.
That was pretty bad, too. But yeah, so showed up at Sundance with a gig because I'd traveled with all my gear and, you know, I liked road trips and it seemed like I would actually, like, get a shot at kicking if I spent the 3 days driving out there. Showed up sick as a dog.
Yeah.
And proceeded. My buddy, what's funny is my buddy Mark E., who was a sober guy, he was the writer.
Okay.
on the Black Book piece, never revealed that he was sober.
Marky. Mikey. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. Go
Mark.
On. Mark. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, go on.
Mark.
Yeah.
Wrote an expose on Scientology.
Know the guy well. Yeah. Yeah.
He was the writer on this piece.
Okay, hilarious.
So I was crashing on his floor, kicking every time we would go in to do, because he would profile people and I'd take their picture.
Right.
So we'd get into their rooms. I mean, I must have stolen half of Paul Schrader's medicine closet.
Oh, so that was just a way in. So you'd get into their rooms.
So I'd get into their rooms, and while Mark was interviewing them, yeah, and I was setting up the lights for the shot, I would just start raiding
and there's good their stuff. Prescriptions. They would bring good stuff to Sundance.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I took a lot of heart medicine. I don't even know what I took, but it kind of got me through.
Right, right. Through your so-called kick.
And so what was funny was... And I remember the staircase up to the condo that we were staying at, feeling, you know, it was, would you say Sisyphean or Herculean? It was Herculean.
Either or good.
To
get up there.
To get up there. It felt like this staircase went on for 8,000 miles.
Right.
When I was dope sick at Sundance. And the next year I was there with Blair Witch.
Right.
You know, was sober 5 or 6 months at that point. And I was like, oh, that takes me like 3 minutes to get up.
Oh, you stayed in the same place.
I stayed around the same place, not in the exact same place.
Yeah, perception is reality.
Yep.
So you got, how did Blair Witch come, just quickly? Like, how did that come to be in your life?
Blair Witch, I was doing, So I got very strung out again. I can't go into the whole Mystic Fire thing. But somehow at like 19, I got this job working at a new Trey video company where I got to hang out with like Allen Ginsberg and Judith Malina and like meet Kenneth Anger and like all these like people who were my fucking heroes.
Right.
And I was very strung out and it's funny because I saw Kill Your Darlings last night and I was thinking about and Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe does a wonderful job. He was so good in that movie. Like playing the life and the heart and the hope of like the inception of the beat scene. Mm-hmm. And by the time I met these people who I'd idolized for years, Ferlinghetti, most of them were like angry and dark. Like Ginsberg was a fucking prick by the time I met him.
Well, and really full blown in addiction, many of
mm-hmm.
them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
and that was the thing. And a lot of them just smoked pot. But I remember Judith from, Living Theater would just literally like made these pinner joints and would just smoke one after the other, after the other, after the other, talking about how the revolution was coming. And, you know, and it was the sad byproduct of people who kind of like at a time and a place in the 60s where it seemed like a people's revolution was actually going to like change the way we acted as a culture. And then it didn't happen. But the rhetoric never changed.
Right.
So it was kind of the same rhetoric that had been used for 35, 40 years, but had been deemed totally impotent at that point. So it was, and in order to keep saying it, you got to stay really stoned and make your world really small.
Right.
And so, you know, and I'll never take away the influence that those people did have on me and you know, what important things I think they brought to the world. But by the time I got there, it was all pretty bleak. So strung out, but part of the way that I'd gotten into that scene was working for this film company and becoming kind of the go-to videographer. So in addition to the photography, I bought one of the first, it was a VX1000, one of the first digital video cameras, Sony video cameras. and learned on one of the first online editing softwares on a Media 100 that was, you know, at my boss's house in Soho, and it was probably the size of this room to do, you know, a tenth as much as what I do on my laptop now.
Right.
And so when somebody brought up this idea for Blair Witch, and I was just in that state. I was, you know, a 20, 21-year-old junkie living in New York, like wearing leather pants, hanging out with like old beat poets. And I really, it was that thing where I was like, you know, I'll be famous, like maybe as an actor.
Right.
Maybe as a model. Maybe as a spoken word poet. Maybe as a writer. Like,
so you didn't even want to be an actor?
No.
Even though your dad was a drama teacher?
No. I mean, that's probably part of why I didn't want to be an actor.
Okay. And so?
So Blair Witch came up, and I hadn't really been acting. Somebody brought it up, and they were like, they need somebody who can run a video camera. And it was because it was an improvised movie. It was just about, you know, this kind of like amalgamation of three personalities and somebody who could, you know, one of those people had to be able to film it all. So
that's
I met.
That's why you got the role?
That's totally why I got the role.
Okay.
That is completely. And they cast me. I went in to meet with Ed, who was one of the two directors, and brought him all this like videography stuff that I'd done. I'd just been down in Peru shooting on a posthumous Joseph Campbell film that my boss was making. And, you know, and I showed him all this stuff, and it was really more about the tech of it. And he cast me right there. And then it was another year before they actually made the film. So by the time they raised, because I think they had to raise like another, you know, $8,000 or $10,000, which took them a year to do, because they were messengers at that point. And so when they were ready to make the film, they started, I became the constant, and they started bringing people in to improvise off me, which was how we narrowed it down. It was like open call New York City. So it was a ton of people, and that's how we narrowed it down to Mike and Heather, and it was the three of us who wound up doing the movie together.
And so clearly you had no idea what a sensation it would be.
No.
Yeah.
No. I was making $500 a week for 2 weeks, which was how long it took us to make the movie. So I made $1,000 to make that movie. And then I had a back-end point on the film.
Oh my God.
I tried desperately
to get more money instead.
I tried desperately to sell that point for $500.
Wait, should I ask? It's tacky to ask how much money you must have made, but an insane amount of money.
No, when all was said and done, because, I mean, let's clear this myth up once and for all, because for years, I think it said on Wikipedia, maybe it still does, that I made like $4 million off the film. People who know me know that I make money and then I go broke, and that's just what I do. And I'd be an asshole if I made that much money
and still went broke.
By the time all was said and done, and we took Artists and the Distributors to federal court in New York to get just what they owed us, I think my payout was about $300,000. So I made a lot more money than I had anticipated making.
Right, but not insane.
But not, it wasn't retirement money.
Right. So, okay. And so then, that even though, you know, being the sensation of the moment doesn't necessarily guarantee a goddamn thing.
No.
At all. So that must have also been a shock. I think that, or was it not? You know, you're sort of the biggest thing for a second. And then.
Well, what's weird. I'll tell you the white limo story, and then...
Then you've got to leave. I've been trying to kick you out for like half an hour.
So when all this first started happening, I just... Bellamy, my friend that I was telling you about, that I was at the movie with last night, we dated for 4 years in my early sobriety. I'd just met her. I'd fallen in love. You know, all this stuff was happening, and it was very easy at that point to go... people are like, I can't believe you stayed sober through that. I was like, that was the easiest thing to stay sober through, because it was like I got sober and like everything amazing happened all at once.
Right, you're like, this sobriety thing works. All your dreams come true.
You're like, oh, this is incredible. Right. This is God's will.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to ride in a town car all the time.
Right.
This is what happened. I mean, I had gone from sleeping in Tompkins Square Park to like a bunk bed to, you know, making really decent money and getting to work with awesome people and having people give me lots of free shit.
Right.
So here was the trajectory because it really was, people talk about overnight success and as you and I both know, lots of things that people call overnight success are like somebody who's been humping it for like 10, 15 years and all of a sudden something breaks and people are like, he came out of nowhere.
Right.
We didn't even know who she was before this. But like internally, they've been working their ass off.
This was not the case for
this
you.
This was not the case. I was a junkie. I got sober. I'd done one movie and all of a sudden I was on the cover of Newsweek.
Right.
So I got the experience of being insanely famous for like 10 minutes. And so the first few months of it, I was like, God's will, man.
Yeah.
This is like of service, sponsor, checking in, meetings, speaker tape,
right.
First priority, like would go to do a film and put my phone number with friends Bill on the call sheets, meetings at lunch. Like this is all like I get that this is what I need to do off the top.
Right.
And then you get busy and you start slacking off a little bit. So about 6 months later, and I'm just grateful for everything. Right. And I'm like the kindest, most grateful person you'll ever meet. About 6 months later, we're going to present at the MTV Awards, Mike and Heather and I. And the limo pulls up. And the publicist is like, okay, come on. Got to get you guys out of here. We've got an appointment on the red carpet in 15 minutes. And I go, oh, guys, I'm so sorry. I can't go. And they're like, what are you talking about? I was like, it's a white limo.
Oh, my God.
They were like, and? I was like, sorry, guys. White limos are tacky. I'm not going to go to an award show in a white limo.
Oh, my God.
And they were like, ha, that's really funny. I was like, no, I'm dead fucking serious. I'm not going to go to an award show in a white limo. So they had to call in and get a black limo.
You're kidding me. Okay.
And they brought us in and we were late to do the carpet and blah, blah, blah. And in my, like, that's how crazy I had gone in that short a time span.
Yeah.
Had no idea and was like saying it nicely.
Right.
I was like,
and it seemed reasonable to you.
You guys can go. You guys can totally go.
Right.
I mean, I still hold to the fact that white limos are tacky, but the fact.
Don't disagree, but yeah.
The fact that I had gone from nothing.
Yeah.
To being picky over the color of the limo that I was being driven to an award show in was like I hated being that famous. I hated it. I love my job. I love working in movies.
You hated it because it made you that asshole or just because you lost privacy or...
And I think part of this is also because I was so fresh in sobriety and so young at the same time. But I hated the loss of privacy. I hated... I hated the fact that... I mean, I'm coming up on 15 years and if I am not vigilant, I am as susceptible as anybody to like spending way too much time caring about the wrong shit.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of times that I've kind of like come back to a recalibration point in my life and thought like all like everything that I was stressed about for however long I was stressed about it doesn't matter at all. Like, and it was all-encompassing moments before that.
I mean, I do think that that we live in a society that's so fucked with the messages it gives us about what's important. And we live in a city and you are in a business that is so fucked about what is important. And it takes constant vigilance to not be at all susceptible to it. You know, I know just...
I mean, and if that's possible, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think sobriety, age, and finding like those four or five people who are your lifers and fucking holding them close because, right. You know, I've got a handful of people who have been in my life now for over a decade.
Right.
Who I trust implicitly.
Right.
When they're like, dude, you're being a cocksucker. I'm like, oh, I'm probably being a cocksucker.
But it also feels bad now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you're aware of it. Yeah. When you're doing it, and it feels shitty. I mean,
but as you probably know, being aware of something and not doing it are two totally separate things.
No, that's true. That's true. And
you know, and that's such a big realization is being the guy who's like, look, I'm just an asshole sometimes.
Right.
I'm sorry, and that's
right.
Just the way I am.
Right.
Is so not the same as not being an asshole.
Yes, I know, and it's funny how similar, how close it seems.
At the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally true.
Anna, what do you want to know?
Okay. Well, yeah. No, we're wrapping up. I kicked you out like 10 minutes ago. You're just lucky that I'm not showing that. And so now you've become a director. And so, I mean, it's hard to summarize the last, I mean, I guess 15 years.
Right.
In a sentence. But, you know, and I almost, you know, so, and I do want to talk a little bit about, so, you know, you gave me that, so this letter, when your brother, was sort of circling the drain with addiction, you wrote this.
This was a year ago. He celebrated a year on Thursday. And what's today? Today's Sunday.
Yeah.
So a year ago today, we were in massive triage with him.
And there was the way that letter was just so, it just is so unjudgmental and so, it just was so compassionate and unjudgmental. And yeah, I mean, I've had, so we published it on After Party Chat and then went on Salon too. And yeah, I mean, I just heard from so many people. And then, even when you put on Facebook, the comments, it was amazing. And I know that was kind of a big thing for you to put out there in a way.
It was. And it was also, if you knew my brother, the fact that he gave permission for it was pretty unbelievable.
Right.
Because I definitely, I mean, look, it's me. I was putting my name on it. I was also happy to do it anonymously, but
right.
I always like when I read something and somebody's owning it with their name. So yeah. I was going to put it out there, but it talked about my family.
Right. Right.
And the fact that my family was so supportive of it, and literally what it was. Yeah, I don't know. If we talk about my brother, you might actually make me cry.
Yeah, you thought I forgot.
Yeah, no. Way to misdirect. But yeah, I was really happy to be able to do it because it was in that way that you see with the people that you love and you so rarely see in yourself. Like you actually have a vantage point to the miracle.
Right.
When somebody actually does make that change. And I have a relationship with my brother now. A year into his sobriety that was impossible. And I had really become one of those guys who was like, okay, I just one of those guys I never wanted to be, who's like, yeah, I haven't talked to my brother in 10 years.
Right.
We just lead separate lives and I hope he's not dead.
Right.
And I never wanted to be that person, but it had just become so painful and so impossible. And that was kind of, that was the last, it was the last act of, it was kind of the last act of love that I had in me.
Right.
Was to just tell him where I'd been. Tell him how much I believed in him. If he was willing to surrender to this process, and then leave it up to him.
And were you surprised that it got through to him?
You know, it was really fucking amazing. And when I tell this story, it sounds like it sounds like I'm taking credit for something that I would never take credit for. I mean, this was God and love and family and like all the, and him hitting a bottom and acknowledging it and all the things that happened. But there was a point where, he was doing exactly what I did before I was thrown in rehab, which is, you know, I'm going to get sober, but I'm going to do it on my own.
Right.
And I was dealing with some massive codependence issues in the family at that point. So I was, you know, I was able as a guy who's been around for a while and had a front row seat to not only my own, overcoming of an opiate addiction, but also seen many others go through it. To kind of go like, this is what I've seen work and this is what I've seen not work. And, you know, had my lovely mother on the other end going, well, you know, he is keeping a chart. He was at 80 oxys last week. He's down to 60 this week. He's planning to wow. like he's, you know, he's really on a taper down and I mean, we've all learned a lot through the process. But the impossibility of just like being at that point where you're like, everything could change, but I can't force it to change. And doing that Al-Anon practice of going, I can get you a free bed in a rehab. I'm here for whatever you need if you're willing to make the big surrender and not try to do this on your own.
Right.
And if you can't do that, I can't sit next to you and watch you kill yourself through half measures.
Right.
And so writing that letter was the one thing that I could do that was clean, that didn't get, you know, it didn't get into the back and forth of like deal making or that shit that you always get sucked into if you're talking to somebody who's deep in their addiction.
Right.
And so I sent it and he called me and even sending it, I was like, I wonder if this is just going to piss him off. Right. It might just piss him off.
Right.
And later on that day he called me and he goes, my brother's hip hop producer. He goes, yo, will you print that letter out and send it to me? And I was like, yeah. He's like, I'm going to take that shit into rehab with me. And it was the first time that he'd been willing at all. And so,
wow,
you know, so whatever it was, I mean, and that's not, again, it's not, love is not, love is like the opposite of ego. So any help that you can give to somebody that you love in those situations is never, it's never like, look what I did. It's like, look what, you know, look what, look what God has given me the capacity for.
Right.
And so in publishing it, I think a big part of it was just going like, look, the amount of times that I've been like a selfish asshole since I wrote that letter and like vastly imperfect, or, you know, you can never count them. But like in that moment, that was a moment of like pure love.
Right.
And I know, you know, I know how hard that is for people to get through when they're dealing with something so impossible as, you know, as a dying loved one.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on.
Great. I mean, what are you going to do? You can go back to like...
Yeah, where can I go? And I mean, I could keep going, but I don't want to see the tears running down your face. I'd feel, you know.
It's good. I'm swallowing all of them right now.
Thank you so much, Joshua.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Joshua Leonard.
Anna.
This was a real pleasure. Thank you for not calling me Anna. Thank you. I'm stopping. I'm really stopping.